Checkerfin.
Fordham was always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly.
Sex,
sex. Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering,
learning and teaching.
In your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your words that they be preaching. Cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah. It's the education gadfly.
Hello, this is your host Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation. Here with my co-host Rick Hess.
Hey, big guy.
How are you, Rick?
Doing well, doing well. How about you?
I'm doing fine. It's been a little while again.
We have. You've been, you were, where the heck were you?
I was in East Tennessee on vacation with my family. We went one day to Dollywood.
Real? I like Dollywood.
Have you been to Dollywood?
I was there when I was hitching cross country. Must have been the mid-80s.
Yeah?
And then I remember when I was leaving, my cab driver wanted to know if I wanted to go anywhere illicit. He started giving me a list of options.
Wait. Like, we're talking about the same Tennessee, not Vegas.
Yeah. And I was going back to my hotel. It's where actually the legislature, at least in the mid-80s, apparently stayed when they were in session. So out of session, I think they let me have a room for like $25 or something. But it felt very posh.
I don't think we're talking about the same place.
We are, baby.
Dollywood, East Tennessee. We're not talking about Opryland or Nashville.
I think I'm talking Dollywood. Maybe I'm talking Opryland. I don't know. Did you like Dollywood?
Dollywood was very fine. If anything,
that's weak.
It was an interesting look at the nation's obesity epidemic. Let's put it that way.
What is very fine? Did you like Dollywood?
It was okay. Megan and I, Megan's 8 months pregnant, so we couldn't go on the rides. Mm. So we went and saw some country music shows, which I liked quite a bit.
And so what's the fat obesity stuff about?
Well, don't you kind of see that at any theme park? I mean, I don't know what it is about theme parks, but I feel like you really get an up close look at the American obesity epidemic. And this is a theme park in the South, where we know there's an even larger obesity epidemic. Anyways, there was just no escaping it. Oof. There was, I understand that on the log ride, like where you go down a big plume and stuff. What am I saying? They have a maximum weight for the ride for all of the people combined. So people have to get on a scale together, and you have to decide if you have, if your boat is too heavy. And I understand the guy that was running this ride was really smooth about not hurting people's feelings, But he'd be like, "Oh, sorry, I think we're going to need to make a little change here. Bring in a 7-year-old to go with the bigger people."
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So this is what it's come to in this country.
But we are getting shorter. Did you see this? That we've now been passed just about every European country?
The Great Danes are beating us on that front.
Some of them are 6-footers, man.
This is how we're going to close this achievement gap with the rest of the world. They're getting taller and smarter. All right. Well, let's get running. We have a big show today. Stephanie DeLuca is coming in for an interview. This means that we are having a serious interview with a serious scholar.
Wow.
Don't you like that?
I like that.
All right.
And DeLuca is going to be talking about what exactly?
She's talking about a new study that came out in Education Next and a piece she wrote on the Moving to Opportunity program. So we'll hear all about that. And of course, we will play a game of Pardon the Gadfly and we will hear our education news of the weird. So let's get started, Christina, with Pardon the Gadfly.
All right. A group of Arizona charter schools recently sued the State Department of Education for mandating a specific sequence of high school courses. The court ruled in the state's favor. Is this a worrying example of the erosion of charter school freedoms?
Answer, yes. I'm with the charters here. Mike, you must be more conflicted.
Well, I'm a little bit conflicted. It was interesting to see that the court did rule in the state's favor. I was surprised by that. The State Department of Education wanted these charter schools teaching, I think it was some of the science and maybe history courses in a particular order, and the charters didn't want to do that. I understand that basically at the end of the day, I say, look, if the kids can pass the test, then I think that's what really matters. And even if they haven't studied the material formally yet, but they can still pass the test, I guess that's all we care about. But it's tricky. As we move, more and more states move to end-of-course exams, it is going to impinge some on the freedom of charter schools. But if you're going to impinge on charter school freedom, it seems to me this is the kind of area where you should do it.
Well, I mean, I think, it makes sense to specify, here's what we're trying to accomplish. But, if a school has good and valid reasons for rearranging course sequence, for instance, the classic biology, chemistry, physics sequence has been derided as, totally backwards for half a century or more. And, we did it that way originally because it was alphabetical. So if we are going to, Mike, figuring it out.
Hey, that's right.
Yeah. So if we are going to require that charters be bound by conventional wisdom in state departments of education when it comes to course sequencing, that's a real issue.
All right. But I do like that Arizona wants there to be some real accountability for subjects other than just math and reading, for example. So the more and more we have these subject-specific tests, I think you're going to see some of these conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, moving across the country, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution editorial board is angry that parents don't have access to information about teacher effectiveness, including value-added data on student test scores, principal evaluations, and so forth. Should consumers have this sort of information, or is teacher effectiveness rightfully the sole domain of administrators?
You know, I think I come in with the editorial board and say parents should have all the information they want in terms of the quality of their child's teacher.
Yeah, I think I got to come down on the other side of this one. Fact is that we believe in holding, you know, police departments accountable or public libraries accountable, but there's nowhere I can go to see how many tickets a policeman wrote last month or see how frequently a given library is losing copies of a particular book. There's appropriate boundaries here of kind of managerial responsibility for the people they employ. And the last thing that I would want as a teacher is to have every yokel in a given school district be free to come up out of context, look at, you know, some performance criteria, which they may or may not be equipped to judge, and start, you know, calling me out by name, you know, with or without any basis in fact on radio stations or newspapers. Strikes me that the problem here, the reason there's a hunger for this information, is because districts aren't collecting it and using it in a sensible way. And so the real solution here is to make sure that school districts are actually managing teachers in a sensible and proper fashion.
Okay, that's all fair and well, and certainly managers should be using this information more than they do, and they should fire teachers that aren't effective and on and on. However, if I'm a parent, I still want to have a lot of information about my teacher. And it's not like the policeman down the street. I have a much more personal relationship. This is a person that is teaching my child all day long. Shouldn't I at least have some basic information? I mean, what information would you be willing to give out to the public about a teacher? Their college they went to? What?
Well, I think that's a reasonable question. It's partly an issue over here. I mean, putting value-added data on, I mean, say year-over-year value-added data in the public domain, you know, if you're teaching, if you're teaching fourth grade and you're talking about a class of 28 kids, year-over-year value-added data is completely unreliable. There's going to be a ton of bouncing, right? This is the famous Kane-Steger problem that came up with looking at.
Yes, thank you, Kobe. But you didn't answer the question, Rick. I mean, what would you be willing to have? Their major, their college that they attended?
And a lot of that obviously is in the public domain. When you go, you know, in most school districts, you can actually obtain a lot of that information currently on mm-hmm. teachers. There is a question of how readily accessible we want to make this stuff, mm-hmm. say, on the internet or in the public domain. The reason I'm hesitant to answer, I think, is because it depends. I mean, that's my answer, is if districts are using this stuff in a sensible fashion, you don't need a ton of it. If they're not doing anything, then we ought to put some out there. And what should be out there, it depends.
It depends. It depends. Okay, Christina, last topic.
All right. Last week, Checker Finn and Diane Ravitch had a Wall Street Journal editorial arguing for the liberal arts in K-12 education. Lots of readers thought they'd gone soft on standards and testing. Is it possible to be in favor of test-based accountability and a broad liberal education?
I should think so. NCLB doesn't make it much easier, but I think that's the end game, Mike.
Well, sure, I hope it can, because I support both ideas, but I think it's tricky. You know, there are a few things we can certainly do. We can make sure that the testing regime is in more than just math and reading. And we see in the new book out by Fordham last month, great paper by Marty West.
What's the title of the book?
It is called Beyond the Basics, Achieving a Liberal Education for All Children. That states that have testing in history and science have not seen the erosion of time spent on history and science. So, you know, having tests in those subjects is important. You know, but how do you make sure the schools don't get rid of art or music, or civics or economics? You're not going to have tests in all of those subjects. I'm not entirely sure how to solve that problem.
And I mean, that's the thorny problem. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is actually where these simple notions of, you know, just coercive accountability alone or choice alone are problematic. What you want is a centralized accountability framework where schools are responsible for making sure that kids are mastering kind of key subjects. But we know that parents tend to favor and support schools which do arts and music and, you know, kind of the classic components of the liberal education. And if you actually build into an accountability framework, responsiveness to family demands and enrollment as real measures of performance, and if schools actually, you know, are awarded for succeeding at attracting families, you can create some really positive incentives there for schools to take these parts of the curriculum seriously.
Interesting. So you could focus on building parental demand for these things, or maybe it already exists, demand for music, art, and the such, and then use that demand to keep schools from getting rid of all of that. Yeah, it's not bad. All right. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Christina. That is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for our special interview this week with Stephanie DeLuca. Joining us today in the studio is Dr. Stephanie DeLuca, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University, here to talk about the Moving to Opportunity study. Stephanie, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Thanks for having me, Mike and Rick.
Hey, good to have you here.
You know, Rick first introduced me to Stephanie, I believe, at an AERA meeting a few years ago.
There you go.
Yeah.
See, I tell you it's worth going, AERA.
It is worth
it. You're always the skeptic.
Well, Stephanie, you have a new paper out in Education Next in the forthcoming issue. It's gotten some press, and we'll talk about that. But tell us a little bit about the Moving to Opportunity project and study. What are the headlines? What did we find out? What did they try to do, and what were the results?
Well, what gives MTO a lot of press is the fact that it was a full-blown social experiment. Meaning it, there was a randomized selection of families into one of three groups, a control group, which means they got nothing, and two groups who got vouchers, housing subsidy vouchers. And one of those groups had to, as a condition of receiving the voucher, move to a non-poor neighborhood. And then another group got the voucher and could move to any neighborhood, in the given metropolitan area. And as some of us may or may not know, experiments are considered a gold standard when trying to recover causal estimates of programs. And
so what did we learn?
And all that. So you don't want some kind of
academic program? No, screw the background. What the hell did we learn?
So depending on who you ask or what outcomes you're measuring, it looked like the program overall had no effect on children's academic achievement as measured by test scores. Okay. Mom's employment or economic self-sufficiency outcomes, but did have positive effects on mom's mental health and some positive effects on girls' behavior. They acted out less often and also improved their mental health outcomes, but seemed to not do so well for boys and show that there was an increase in delinquent behavior for the boys in the experimental group.
So that means that the boys actually socially were doing worse in the experimental group?
In the experimental group, the boys were doing worse on average. And these are the results from the quantitative evaluation.
So what's the takeaway from all this?
Well, that's a little complicated. The takeaway is that social experiments aren't simple and can easily be misunderstood. And I think the takeaway on the one hand is neighborhoods don't matter. The takeaway on the other hand is changing neighborhoods is a necessary but not sufficient condition for improving child and family well-being.
So let's summarize then. So the program was to try to experiment with poor families to leave their poor neighborhoods, go to neighborhoods that weren't as poor, and see if it was good for the families, for the kids, and so forth. So let's talk about the academic achievement piece in particular. You did part of the study where you got on the ground, did a lot of interviews with families, and found out what was going on. Mm-hmm. So what did you find out that could explain why the results might not have been more positive?
Well, what I found out that confirmed the quantitative findings was that a number of families didn't move their children to school districts in the outlying suburban areas or in the lower poverty census tract areas. So that was not so much a surprise. But what was...
Let's go back. You mean they kept their child in the same school?
The same school district or the same school.
So they moved to a different apartment, but they kept sending the kid back to the old neighborhood.
Occasionally, that was the case. That I found in the interviews. We also found that it was sort of interesting how parents approach the sort of schooling choice issue. A lot of middle class families sort of think about a calculus, like, you know, how academically rigorous is a school? Are the teachers really qualified? You know, teacher student ratio. These are families who are dealing with some serious problems. So they're dealing with unexpected deaths in the family, just making ends meet, addiction. So parents coming in and out of, losing the ability to take care of their children. So there are some of the daily issues they're dealing with. Actually put schooling not so much at the top of the list, but sometimes at the bottom. So what we assume is that, you know, poor families are putting school choice at the top, but that's not always the case because there are other issues to deal with that are more pressing. We found a lot of parents tended to defer to their children to make schooling decisions about where they were comfortable going to school. Also found that, a lot of these moms in particular in these families, never experienced a good school. They never attended one their kids have never, you know, sort of been in a good school. So they weren't exactly expecting very much from schools. And so, you know, nice teachers, kind of a sense of community was enough to make them happy, calling about problems, but no discussion of academic rigor. So moving to a better neighborhood, they didn't often seek out these better schools. It's kind of a, you know, sort of what they know kind of phenomenon.
It's it almost seems like an argument against school choice. I mean, to say that these poor parents were not very good consumers of education.
Well, that implies that they had information about choice options, right? Which I think is what's really interesting here. I mean, what I did was, you know, qualitative work, which, you know, it tends to be good at helping us understand how and why things happened or how and why policies succeed or fail. Mm-hmm. So what we learn is that there's an information poverty problem. You know, it's one thing to say, do parents not want you know, they're told to go to better schools or they don't care. And neither one of those things was the case. I mean, parents recognize the importance of education, but if you don't know what better options are, or if you don't understand that your child's school has been labeled failing, then taking, you know, being taking an active stance to improve that is unlikely.
Yeah. And yet in the Washington Post story the other day, Jay Matthews, the reporter, made it sound like you were saying that the parents just said, well, the school doesn't really matter if the kid is motivated.
I actually didn't get a phone call from Mr. Matthews to comment on the story. So the story was a bit of a surprise to me. So I wasn't interviewed or contacted by email for the story. But, you know, sort of the summary that he includes in the story, in his story, I think was not accurate. It wasn't an accurate representation of the research in the article. On the one hand, you know, he correctly notes that many of the parents in these families expected that if their children wanted to work hard enough, the education was there no matter where they went to school, which is kind of striking because these are the poorest families in the nation. And the idea that they would assume that hard work will trump all, I mean, it's just these are not the kinds of families that you would assume would be talking this way. So it was kind of surprising. You know, a lot of parents are saying, you know, I send my child to hell every day and expect her to learn. But at the end of the day, it's up to the individual to make a difference. So on the one hand, you know, the sort of work ethic was present. On the other hand, you know, Matthews says that, you know, that my article, you know, characterizes parents as having the opinion that better schools and better teachers won't matter. And, you know, it's one thing to have parents be skeptical of public schools that have let them down years and years, you know, year after year. It's another thing for parents to be fully informed about better schooling options in the area, get an opportunity to send their kids there, understand what the relationship is between better schools and better teachers and child outcome, and then have parents say, ah, you know, forget it. I mean, that's not what the study showed, and I think is one way that the article, the Post coverage, could be construed. And it's a little more complicated.
You can say it, Stephanie. Jay Matthews got it wrong, didn't he?
I think Jay Matthews got it partly wrong.
All right. Well, you heard it here first on the Education Gadfly Show. All right. Well, Stephanie, thank you for coming on the show. It sounds like very interesting work that you got to do. And everybody should check out the article at educationnext.org.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Steph.
Thanks, Rick.
So what do you think, Rick? It sounds to me like this is a pretty strong argument against school choice, or at least the school choice the way we've been doing it, huh?
It raises a bunch of questions, and, you know, it points the whole problem of this whole romanticizing of, you know, single parents who are working jobs or folks who are, you know, otherwise trapped in poverty, and this notion that they have a lot of trouble with health care, they have a lot of trouble with welfare, they have a lot of trouble with employment. But somehow they are going to be magnificent arbiters of school quality. Always seemed a little shaky.
Yeah. And, of course, it does smack of social engineering as well. You know, let's try to move parents around instead of focusing on fixing the schools in their own neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
You know who hates social engineering?
No.
Liam Julian, who is here to tell us about the education news of the weird. Mm. Liam, what is weird this week?
That was a nice segue, babe.
Thank you. He really does hate social engineering.
Liam, do you?
I do.
Okay.
You can read about it in the Gadfly this week.
Wow.
So, Liam, once again, what is weird this week?
Spontaneous combustion is not a pretty thing, especially when it occurs to elementary school playgrounds. That's what happened in Arlington, Texas, where a recent heat wave caused, quote, engineered wood fiber, unquote, material to burst into flames. Deputy Fire Marshal Keith Ebel said the fire, which occurred at Anderson Elementary, apparently started from heat generated by, among other things, high temperatures.
Oh, in Texas. Wow.
Quote, "It was like a perfect storm," he said. That's kind of true, but storms, especially the perfect variety that exist in Platonic form, typically involve precipitation. which one can only assume would have quashed the flames. Did Marshal Ebel actually mean to say that he, quote, wished for a perfect storm? We may never know. He did, however, encourage those with mulch piles to turn them at least every couple of weeks. Now, with temperatures over 100 degrees, mulch can easily catch fire. Quote, if you haven't turned it in the last 2 weeks, you probably can't stick your hand in it, unquote, Marshal Ebel said. It remains unclear whether he meant that literally or metaphorically. Rick, do you use mulch?
I'm scared to death of playgrounds now. You know, if 100-degree heat is enough to send these things up, man, they can just go up any time.
This is a good argument against year-round schooling. There it is.
You know, I mean, mulch, that's... So, now, why would you stick your hand in a pile of mulch?
It remains unclear whether he meant that literally or metaphorically.
Thank you. Wow, we
got to give kudos this week to Greg Toppo from the USA Today education reporter. Greg sent us a tip on this story.
That, you know, that's what we like. We like our network of listeners out there to always be kind of on the ground. That's how Dave Barry has done those columns all those years.
I especially like it when bona fide reporters send us tips.
Well, USA Today probably want to give him a lot of column inches for the combustible playground.
Oh, this is what people care about. Yeah.
This is good stuff. That'd be a good box on the corner of page one. How many playgrounds go up in flames in a given year? That would be a cool. I'd buy that paper.
Good. Well, thank you, Liam. That was certainly weird. We are out of time. We will see you next week. In the meantime, read the Education Gadfly at www.edexcellence.net. Till then,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.